I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One week ago, a federal judge gave final approval to a huge settlement aimed at improving mental health care in the Granite State. The deal came after years of complaints and then legal battles over a state mental health system that almost everyone agreed was inadequate. The suit was titled Amanda D. versus Hassan, named for one of the plaintiffs and the Hassan administration. But the governor herself praised the settlement in her State of the State address.
It also ensures that we can continue addressing our mental health challenges in a fiscally responsible way that protects the state's budget and ensures that New Hampshire citizens are driving improvements in our mental health system, not federal judges.
Now it's up to the executive branch and state lawmakers to fulfill the settlement's terms. This includes finding more than $30 million to pay for what it requires, a wide array of expanded community-based mental health services. Today in The Exchange, moving ahead with mental health. We'll find out what's next with this agreement and what roadblocks it may meet along the way. Let's hear from you. If you have personal experience with New Hampshire's mental health system, what do you hope comes out of this? What concerns do you have about the future? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour who've been heavily involved in this. Ken Norton is here, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire. And Ken, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Amy Messer, legal director of the New Hampshire Disabilities Rights Center. She was a key player in litigating the new mental health settlement. And Amy Messer, good to have you. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Rebecca Woodard, Assistant Attorney General at the New Hampshire AG's office. She's been working on this settlement issue. And Rebecca, it's good to meet you. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Well, and Ken, before we talk about the settlement and all it involves and what may change, let's just go back very quickly into where this came from. How did it happen, Ken, that New Hampshire went from boasting national ratings of A for its mental health system for many years to a D by the mid-2000s?
So, quick historical perspective. In 1957, when the population of the state was 750,000, three-quarters of a million, our census at our state hospital was 2,700 adult beds. And if we fast forward into the 1980s, when deinstitutionalization was occurring around the country, we were kind of late to the game. And because we were late to the game, we benefited by seeing what worked in other states and what didn't work. And we had a real brain trust in our Division of Mental Health, who, you know, were visionary people, Don Shumway and those folks. And they really developed a community-based plan for our state that that focused on services, a continuum of services in the community, crisis beds and group homes and day treatment programs, vocational services at all the different community mental health centers. Another key milestone here was in the late 80s, the legislature approved the plan to build a small state-of-the-art state hospital. And this was very unusual because every place else in the country was closing down hospitals, and we associated with Dartmouth, the psychiatric services there, opened that facility in 1990 with about 200 beds. And that gives perspective on, you know, compared to where we were in 1957. That plan of that small hospital really involved a very strong system of community-based care, including designated receiving facilities or DRFs at local general hospitals. There were several private psychiatric hospitals operating in the state. And, you know, it was a couple of years after that that we were rated number one in the country.
Wow, which seems amazing given all we've heard in recent years about people languishing in the ER, you know, jails and prisons. There was one sheriff who said he felt like he was running a psychiatric ward, not a jail. So what happened and when, Ken?
Well, and I guess I always add the perspective that our NAMI founder, Peggy Straw, at the time said, when we were number one in the country. Great. We're the smartest kids in the dumb class. That this is if this is the best that we can do for people with mental illness in our country, that it's a sad commentary.
So it still could have been better. That's
the point. I mean, that's not without the pride of the of what we had developed, but it was, you know, recognizing what you said about jails, institutions, other problems within the system. So what happened was a lot of changes at the state level, but at the federal level, payment, closure of local hospital units, closure of private psychiatric hospitals, reimbursement levels weren't correct, slow reductions in funding of those community-based services, so caseloads increasing, all these things that, you know, that just eroded essentially the system over time, and finally resulted in a system which is very much in crisis. And the biggest example of that is the current situation with people waiting in emergency rooms. But certainly the rates of incarceration of people with mental illness in jails is also a prime example.
Well, and we've talked to police a lot about this on this program. One more question for you, Ken, and then I do want to bring our other guests in. You talked a lot about, and others have talked about, you know, what the state hasn't done, you know, state budget cuts and state policy decisions. What about private insurers, Ken? Were there changes over this 20 or 30 year period in the private insurance system that also affected the mental health care system here in New Hampshire?
Yes, and that's a really important question. I mean,
because the state often gets blamed.
Yeah, and it's not just the state, but we were one of the first states in the country to pass a parity bill to require insurance companies to provide mental health treatment on par with physical disorders. But the insurance companies always managed to find a way around things. And, you know, so there were lifetime caps, there were pre-existing conditions, there was essentially, you know, preventing people with mental illness from getting access to treatment.
All right. So as you said, the system deteriorated. And Amy Messer, when and why did your organization decide it was time to get involved, time to file a suit perhaps?
Well, you know, we had been looking at this for a number of years, largely driven by a very, very high number of calls from individuals with mental illness or their family members or guardians who recognized that the services just weren't available. And, you know, people were ending up in homelessness, in jails, and in the state hospital, even when community services would have provided them the kinds of services and supports they would have needed to stay in their homes and in their communities. And I mean, I think, you know, what Ken was talking about in 1989, when we looked at this, we saw that New Hampshire Hospital had about 900 admissions a year. By 2011, that had skyrocketed to 2,400 admissions a year. And that's as we saw the decline in community mental health services.
Yeah, they had nowhere else to go but the state hospital.
Exactly. I mean, so, you know, you could see through both the data and the anecdotal stories that we were hearing from individuals that really the decline in the community mental health system was causing a lot of unnecessary institutionalization. So we were looking at this with both regard to the state hospital as well as the Glencliff Home, which is a nursing facility up in northern New Hampshire where, you know, once people ended up there, the vast, vast majority of them never left.
I mean, very remote.
Very remote. You were more likely to die there than you were to ever return to the community. So we had very significant concerns about that. We did do, as I say, we did an investigation. We did communicate with the state around that. Ultimately, we're unable to resolve the differences and come to agreement. And ultimately, we then filed a suit.
Where does the issue of rights come in? As I said, you're legal director at the Disabilities Rights Center. So everyone would hear you and Ken talk and say, yeah, that's a bad situation. But where does the issue of rights being violated come in to the point where you file a suit?
Well, the Americans with Disabilities Act does include a provision that requires that if the state is going to provide services, that those services be offered in the most integrated setting appropriate to a person's needs. So, you know, both the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act kind of address this issue by directing the states to ensure that the community services are available so that people aren't unnecessarily institutionalized. And I should say that, you know, one of the other things that we know is that community services are far more cost effective than institutional service. So it's both good for people, good social policy, but also good fiscal policy to provide those services in the community.
And we'll definitely get into some more detail on that in a minute. But I want to get you into this too, Rebecca Woodard. What's the Attorney General's office role in, you know, moving this thing forward, seeing that it starts to happen, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G?
Well, our role as the counsel to the department will be working with them to ensure implementation as this goes forward. And this is much larger than just the Department of Health and Human Services, but partnering with all of those community providers to ensure that the appropriate education and resources are available for the department to be able to live up to the services it agreed to provide under the settlement agreement.
How big a job is this going to be for the state, Rebecca?
This is a large job. There's going to be a lot of individuals involved, a lot of moving parts. But a number of the provisions in the agreement are enhancing current services that we already provide through providers that are already up and running. In addition, there are a number of services that are brand new to New Hampshire, and there will be a lot of resources put toward developing those services and getting them up and running. Because of that, we have structured the agreement in a way that allows implementation of many of those services in the next biennium, so we can plan for them financially and practically speaking to ensure we have the workforce and resources to make it happen.
And we will talk with Commissioner Tumpas in a moment. You mentioned Health and Human Services. What's the cost that the Attorney General's office estimates that it'll take, Rebecca, to implement this thing?
Well, to be clear, the costs are estimated by the department. The way the agreement was entered into, we agreed to provide certain services on a certain timeline. And after we came to a final agreement, the prospective costs were developed by the department based on the services that they're currently providing and their experience in the industry. We really are looking at the fiscal impact for this biennium and then next biennium.
For a grand total of $30 million, I think that's what I've heard, or a little more than $30
million? For the two bienniums.
Yeah, so
correct.
4 years. All right. Well, in just a moment, as I said, we'll talk with Commissioner Nick Tumpas because, as Rebecca Woodard said, his department, Health and Human Services, will be a big, big player in rolling out this settlement, in fulfilling its terms. We'll start taking your calls, too, in just a moment. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson is coming to New Hampshire. She'll be the next guest in our Justice and Journalism series, a joint project with the Ruttman Center at UNH School of Law. Liasson will be discussing recent political and legal trends in the country. Join us at the Law School in Concord, March 13th. Reserve your space at nhpr.org. This event sponsored in part by the Couch Family Foundation. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny this morning, clouding up this afternoon with a chance of snow showers, highs today, low to mid-30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from People's United Bank, offering retail and business solutions to meet banking needs in branches and online at peoples.com. And Dartmouth Hitchcock Primary Care Doctors and Nurses, who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the new mental health care settlement in New Hampshire, where the funds to pay for it might come from, and what types of programs they might support. We invite you to join us with your thoughts, questions, comments. If you have personal experience with New Hampshire's mental health care system, what are your hopes for this new settlement as it rolls out? What are some of the concerns you have about the future? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us now on the phone is Nick Tumpas. He's Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Commissioner Tumpas, thanks a lot for your time. We really appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, how much input did you have, Commissioner Tumpas, into the settlement, into how it would look, into how big it would be?
I had various checkpoints along the way. I had a team of people that worked very closely with the Attorney General's office and others on this, and as they were going through the various proposals and options, they would come back and provide checkpoints to myself and others, and so I was fully in agreement with what was the settlement in terms of the various components of it.
What do you think is most important about this, Commissioner Tumpas?
Well, I think what's most important for me is something that we have been talking about here at the department. I heard a little bit earlier about some of the reductions that we've seen over the number of years and the consequences of some of those, and where people would end up in inappropriate levels of care, a prison, county, or state, or homeless, and that just really is wrong. And so whatever could be done in order to bring greater visibility and the need for action on the part of the state and the local communities was going to be welcome.
So at some level, were you glad you were sued?
You asked me that before. I wish it hadn't come to that, because it was it's a fairly expensive proposition. But in the end, if we are able to add to the infrastructure and the capacity of the system to basically deal with this population in our state, then I'll take the consequences of that.
The settlement talks a lot about what are called mobile crisis teams, local teams that can get to folks quickly when they are in a crisis. How quickly can your department, Commissioner Tumpas, get these up and running?
Well, the implementation for the mobile crisis teams really is into next calendar year. That would begin in April, I believe, of 2015. The implementation of the various components of the settlement, Laura, which I would also add dovetail very, very nicely with the department's own efforts around the 10-year plan and the money that we have in our current budget. There's some overlap. The terms of the settlement basically add additional capacity, for example, assertive community treatment teams and others that really dovetail very nicely with the plan that we already are in the process of implementing. But I can't really go beyond the planning and design of this until the funding is secured. So we are gearing up. We've got a team of people who are working and looking at what we need to do here. We've been in communication with the governor's office, and in fact, really talking with her as well as other parts of the state government, because we're going to need some help, whether it's the Attorney General's office or other areas in the state, as well as to reach out to the people out in the local community related to housing, law enforcement, and so forth.
Yeah, and we were talking about the funding just a moment ago. I have read that your department's calling for about $30 million, maybe more like $32, $33 million, Commissioner Tumpas. Is that right?
Well, right now, my primary focus would be securing the funding for this current biennium and for the general funding that is needed for the current biennium is about $5.9 million. That's the components for the department. That does not include any of the legal fees that are associated with it. But for the department, in terms of the things that we need to come up with, is we need the funding is this roughly $6 million over the course of the biennium. The additional roughly around another $23 million over the next biennium, 16 and 17, I will deal with that and make that as a formal part of our request when we go in and do the budget, which will begin in earnest at the end of this calendar year.
So where do you think the money might come from, Commissioner Tumpas? Are you looking at the surplus? Are you looking at possible cuts in other programs in your department?
My responsibility is to basically present what it is that is needed and how we would go about doing this to the legislature. It is really up to them in order to basically appropriate the dollars. I know that there was a hearing on that last week. I was asked by one of the representatives. Could we find this money in our existing budget? I was pretty clear that that was probably not the the thing that I would be able to do without having a huge impact elsewhere within the department's budget, which is already strained to begin with. So that was really not, in my mind, a viable option. But where they go, it is really up to the policymakers that need to determine that.
How does the settlement, Commissioner Tumpas, address the shortage of just staffing in the state to better staff the state's mental health system, the shortage of psychiatrists in the state, for example, the shortage of child psychiatrists, especially, that I've heard about? How does the settlement begin to address that, especially given that Medicaid reimbursements are so low? You know, it's not a huge incentive for people to jump into this field.
Well, again, there's a number of things when we look at the other part of this, which is related but not quite related directly, is the issue that's being debated at the State House in terms of Senate Bill 413, which is the New Hampshire Health Protection Program, again, the Medicaid expansion. And as part of that, there are dollars that flow in for substance use disorder services and so forth. So there is clearly a challenge. It's a good challenge for people to have in terms of saying, now that we have some funding in order to basically pay for some of these services, we need to develop the workforce and the capacity in order to be able to provide those services. It's not going to be easy, but those are some of the things that we are looking at, how to jumpstart that whole particular process right now.
Last question for you, Commissioner Tumpas, if I could, please. How do you feel about state policy and state spending being driven by lawsuits? Kind of reminds me of Claremont.
Well, I have a little sign in my office that says it is what it is. I have my responsibility as a department leader and administrator is I have a mission of the department. We have an obligation to serve these people. I wish there were other ways in which to be able to go about doing that. But in the end, if this provides some of the funding and the impetus for the general population to understand that these folks really need services and help, they can recover, they can live productive lives, and it would be doing it appropriately would stop some of the inappropriate spending of dollars, scarce dollars, in areas that we shouldn't be spending, whether it's in corrections or the human toil of whether it's homelessness or suicides or some of the other untold effects of not dealing with the issue appropriately in the first place.
So, in other words, we're already paying for it. We just don't see
it
as direct.
We are paying for it. We have talked about that in the program before. That's one of the things that you see when you look at things in a systemic level, is that if you don't deal with it appropriately, the problems just don't disappear. They manifest themselves in other areas. I heard Ken talking about it a little bit earlier about, you know, the impact in terms of what this has on the emergency rooms of hospitals. And again, the folks don't belong there, but in absence of some of the other type of services, that's what's happening. So their services are being somewhat provided, but they're not the appropriate level of services that need to be provided that would allow people to basically recover and lead as productive a lives as they're possible.
All right. Commissioner Tumpas, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Nick Tumpas, Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Join us as we look at some of the details of this big new mental health settlement in New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions, comments, concerns about what this settlement might entail, or personal experiences with New Hampshire's mental health care system, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Amy Messer with the Disabilities Rights Center. I'd like your response to that question I asked Commissioner Tumpas. Should we have state policy, state spending being driven by lawsuits instead of the regular political process?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question. I think that, I mean, sometimes we find that lawsuits are necessary to move people, you know, to move the state forward. This isn't the first time in the disability area. The closing of the Laconia State School was driven by a lawsuit. But I think what's really important, and I think Commissioner Tumpas did a really good job of kind of talking about what the end result of this was in terms of what it means for people. So here, you know, at the end of the day, yes, there was a lawsuit, but we were able to come together as advocates, as community members, as the state of New Hampshire, the United States Department of Justice, the AG's office, to craft a really comprehensive, thoughtfully designed settlement agreement that is going to significantly improve the lives of individuals with mental illness and their family members. And I agree with Commissioner Tumpas that at the end of the day, that's what's important. So, you know, people with mental illness can be full, productive members of our communities, hold jobs, you know, engage with their families, but sometimes need those supports. And making those supports available, which is what we've done through this agreement, is going to make all the difference.
Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Ken Norton, again, just following up with Commissioner Tumpas, we talked a little bit about crisis teams, and the settlement does talk a lot about those. What are they? Who are they intended to help?
Well, the mobile crisis response teams, there's really sort of two pieces to this. those are teams that we don't have in New Hampshire right now that would be essentially available to respond to somebody's house who's not necessarily known to the mental health system. That would start in Concord. Concord at Riverbend has a new executive director, Peter Evers, and he led a mobile crisis response team in Massachusetts for many years. So it's great that it's kind of starting there with somebody who does have that experience.
So is this brand new for New Hampshire?
It is brand new for New Hampshire. New Hampshire has 24/7 emergency coverage in all of the 10 community mental health regions, but it tends to occur from the emergency department. The mental health centers respond to the emergency department to a central location and see people there. This would actually be...
And again, that's not the right place,
well,
the ER.
It's not, but it's complex because sometimes people are presenting with medical conditions. They need to be medically cleared. There's security issues. I mean, there's a number of challenges. And being a large rural state, if you respond to somebody's home in, you know, the corner of a catchment area or, you know, the region that you're in, and then you get a call from the other opposite end, how do you cover that?
Yeah. I know you want to jump in, Amy. Rebecca, thoughts from you, and then we'll go to our listeners. Go ahead, Amy.
Well, I just wanted to say, I mean, mobile crisis is a proven effective method of serving people with mental illness who may be experiencing a psychiatric emergency and diverting people from the emergency room. So they can meet people in the community, in their homes, where the crisis arises. And it's been shown that by meeting people in the community and keeping them out of the emergency room, they are far less likely to ever end up at the state hospital for, you know, a more prolonged period. So some of the individuals will be unknown to the community mental health centers, but some certainly will be known to the mental health centers if they are on an assertive community treatment team that would serve as their mobile crisis team. Otherwise, this mobile crisis team will be able to meet them in the community where they are.
Yeah. Rebecca, your thoughts on some of the issues that Commissioner Tumpas raised or this idea of new mobile crisis teams?
With regard to mobile crisis teams and the new implementation, this is an area that we absolutely took advantage of the opportunity to work together and develop this in a way that we believe we can successfully implement it in New Hampshire. It's a staged implementation where we're entering one region at a time. We're doing it into the future so that we have the time to prepare that and look to other areas that have done it successfully, and hopefully by implementing it in a way that we choose to, we can do it successfully rather than a couple of years down the road risk a court telling us how to do it.
All right. Let's go to the phones. And Karen's calling from Laconia. Hi, Karen. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I was wondering if there are any plans or proposals for increasing housing opportunities and supports for folks with chronic mental illness. I used to work in the local area mental health center, and if someone lost their place to live, it was always a crisis, and it's only gotten worse from what I understand. So I was just wondering the status of that.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. And Ken, the settlement does talk about housing.
It talks a lot about housing, and Karen, thank you. It's a great question. And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, I worked at the Community Mental Health Center in the Lakes region as well, and we had two fully staffed group homes 24 hours a day. We had crisis beds at the group home. We had a crisis couch, and we also had the ability to admit somebody to the local hospital for 24 hours for observation. But what people really need is permanent housing, and it with the cost of rent and with the amount of money that people, if they're on disability, get, it's very difficult. So then they're eligible for what's called Section 8, which is a federal housing subsidy. But the waiting period can be very long for that, and the settlement provides for some bridge money to cover so that people can get housing and get support so that they can maintain their housing, which is a critical, you know, part to this, and then become eligible for Section 8.
Well, and that's an implementation piece. And again, Rebecca, to you and Amy, at times local concerns come up about housing for people with mental illness. Some neighborhoods say, you know, I don't want a group home in my neighborhood. How will you work with that, Rebecca? And Amy, I know you have some thoughts there too.
Well, first, I think it's important to point out that the majority of money going toward housing is for housing subsidies, where individuals will be independent in their own apartments in the community. These are not group homes that we're looking to build. This is purely a subsidy to allow people to maintain independent housing.
Where they may be living already.
Correct, where they may be living already or are just another tenant or another neighbor in a community.
Sure. So these issues might not come up around, you know, zoning and not in my backyard and so forth.
No, absolutely not. We have not added group homes with the exception of four individual units for individuals with complex medical needs who may be leaving Glencliff home. But the majority of the housing provided for this is independent housing, not group housing.
Given the concerns about Glencliff. Amy, real quick, yeah?
The settlement agreement does call for a minimum of 450 supported housing units. And as Rebecca said, those are integrated, scattered site housing. And they come with supports. So there will be support to help people maintain their homes and ensure that they have stable housing and that, you know, that tenancy works well for them and they have the support for that.
All right. Well, Karen, great question. Thank you. And you can join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. More conversation about the big new mental health settlement in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the political standoff in Ukraine takes a deadly turn. Then a special Diane Rehm Show rebroadcast of a 1988 interview with Shirley Temple Black. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and the support also comes to us from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, a member of SIPC. And from the City of Claremont, information about Claremont's economic development initiatives and business relocation at claremontnh.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, we'll be sitting down with Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer of New Hampshire's 2nd District. We'll be talking about some of the big issues on Capitol Hill, and we invite you to send us your comments for the Congresswoman before the program at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Right now, we're talking about the new mental health settlement, what it means for New Hampshire, especially those who struggle with mental illness and their families. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800 800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Deli's calling from Concord. Hi, Deli. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
First of all, I want to say hi to my friend Amy. I love her, and I love the work she's doing. I am frustrated with the system in many ways, but one of the things I'd like to see changed immediately is psychiatrists being able to share patients. My son had a situation where he wasn't quite in crisis mode and didn't need to go to the hospital, but he couldn't get in to see his psychiatrist because he was on vacation and they wouldn't allow him to see another psychiatrist. So we had a 3-week wait where we teetered on going to the hospital or not in order to get some services for my son. And that's a very frustrating piece in the system I'd like to see changed immediately.
And Deli, just I'm curious now, how did it resolve itself? What happened?
Well, we ended up through long nights and sleepless nights of keeping him out of the hospital, which is always our goal. He has had 5 hospitalizations.
Wow.
So sometimes it's inevitable. But we ended up making it to the appointment where the doctor was able to help him adjust his meds. But it was 3 long, frustrating weeks.
Yeah, Deli, I'm so sorry. And thank you for calling in with your story. And, you know, Amy, I've heard stories like this, too. It's not so bad that he needs to go to the ER, but boy, he really needs to see somebody. And then if you don't see somebody, it does end up in the ER. Does
right.
the settlement address this?
Well, the settlement does address a number of services that may be useful in this kind of circumstance. One, we've talked a little bit about mobile crisis. One of the things we didn't say regarding mobile crisis is, in addition to having a mobile crisis team that could, you know, go out and meet with the individual in the community in their home, each mobile crisis team will also have access to what's called a crisis apartment. You know, it's a quiet, home-like environment, an actual apartment that will be staffed both by peers but also have clinical oversight so that sometimes people just, you know, they don't need to go to the hospital, but they need to go somewhere else. And they can the individual can stay there with 24/7 support for up to 7 days. So that's, I mean, that's one thing that will be built into mobile crisis that might be helpful in this circumstance to keep people out of those emergency rooms and have somebody with them until they can stabilize. The other thing that is included in this agreement is the expansion of what's called assertive community treatment teams, otherwise known as ACT. And each of those teams will have a team of professionals, including a psychiatrist, a functional support worker, a nurse, that will go out and visit individuals every day, sometimes twice a day, or less as they need it. It's a comprehensive, flexible support. And the important thing there is that everybody on the team will know each individual that that team is serving. So it's really a shared caseload. But it's very, very comforting, I think, to the individual who is served by that team because the people who are responding to them are people who are known to them.
So even if it isn't your one person, at least it's not some brand new face that you've never seen
before. Exactly, exactly. So this set of comprehensive, flexible supports would help somebody, for example, in Deli's son's situation if he were on that ACT team.
Well, Deli, thanks for sharing your story. And let's go next to Manchester where Rose is waiting. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Yes, my son tried to get counseling for addiction, but he was denied because they said he was only an addict. He didn't meet their requirements. Consequently, he went back to prison. He's still there now for this time for a parole violation because he was using and for stealing diapers.
Wow.
He's been in there now since August of 2012. For this, he's still in there. And I can't tell you how the prison treats addicts the worst. Most of the addicts are in levels 4 and 5, where they're in isolation. They have spent already on my son $500,000. $500,000. Now, of that money, he is going. He needs so much help, so much counseling. Not just because of addiction, but because of all the years in prison. It's their fault, too. 50-50.
Rose, this is really tough. I'm so glad that you called because you bring up a couple points. So I did want to raise them with you, Ken Norton, and perhaps others. She's hitting on a very important point that you and I have talked about before. That's the what they call co-occurring. That's kind of technical, so I don't like to use that term. But that's when someone not only has substance abuse problems, but also mental health problems. In the past, sometimes you couldn't get treatment for your mental health issues until you, quote unquote, got off the stuff. Is that still the case?
As the commissioner had pointed out, we still do not have a substance use disorder benefit that is part of that is available for people with Medicaid in the state. It is part of the Affordable Care Act, and to your previous question about insurance companies and discrimination, the Affordable Care Act has insisted that there are 10 essential health benefits that need to be offered, and one of those is treatment for substance use disorders. And so that will be made available regardless of whatever policy, health insurance policy you get in the future. But New Hampshire is still working towards that. The department hopes to get that online in the coming year, and if the bill that the commissioner referenced that was heard yesterday in the Senate, the New Hampshire Health Protection Program would offer a substance use disorder benefit. I think the other thing that that's very important that Rose brings up is that when you look at rates of incarceration for people with mental illness, what you see is that over the past 70 years that they're relatively unchanged. But what has changed dramatically is that very few people now are hospitalized or held in hospitals. They're held in jails and prisons. And so for those people, many people with mental health issue also have substance use disorder, and that complicates things and has much poorer outcomes for those people, including incarceration, homelessness, legal system, suicide, et cetera.
What are your thoughts, Rebecca, on this issue of incarceration, lack of treatment for folks in prison? And so, you know, the cycle just continues. I wonder if you have thoughts on that or if how the settlement might address these issues.
I'd like to stick to how the settlement addresses or doesn't address these issues. We're clear in the settlement that this is for treatment of mental illness and mental health crises. It does not exclude individuals with co-occurring substance use disorders, but the focus of this agreement is limited to the class that was defined in the lawsuit and the services that we're seeking to provide under that. But we do know that what happens with substance use disorder treatment going forward and the availability of services absolutely affects the population in general, as well as those individuals with mental illness, and we would like to see those systems continue to grow together to provide services that meet both of those needs.
Well, actually, you raise an important question. So who is, if I could put it this way, covered by this agreement, and who isn't?
The agreement focuses on individuals with serious mental illness who are institutionalized or at risk of institutionalization.
It doesn't cover folks.
Or unnecessary institutionalization.
Like Rose's son who's in prison.
Well, it actually does, depending on what his circumstances are, in the sense that the individuals would be individuals who have a serious mental illness, as that's defined, in the state laws and regulations, who are either in one of these institutions, but as Rebecca said, at risk of institutionalization, which is defined very, very broadly.
And a prison is an institution.
Well,
or are we only talking about the state hospital?
We're talking about the state hospital and Glencliff, but the at-risk population includes people who are who've utilized an emergency room for a psychiatric issue in the last 2 years, who are homeless as a result of their mental illness, people who have had law enforcement contacts in the last 2 years as a result of their mental illness. So, there are several other categories. So it's defined quite broadly. I mean, if your mental illness affects you in a way that puts you at risk of being hospitalized, for example, you would then be included in the class. So it's possible that...
That's why they call it a class action lawsuit. It covers a big class of people. Go ahead, Amy.
Exactly. And it's not... a fixed point in time. It's not who's in this class right now, but an individual who is identified as an individual with serious mental illness who might meet one of the criteria would be considered a class member and eligible for these services.
So does that mean that Rose's son and the so many other people in our prisons and jails who have mental illness, that they are all of a sudden going to get the services that they need?
Well, some of, you know, I mean, it's hard to say whether Rose's son in particular would meet the criteria,
sure,
not knowing
but,
anything.
But generally, people in prison and jail, does this help them? Because there are a lot in there who struggle with mental illness, as you know.
Yes. I think it will help some of those folks. I mean, as they're transitioning out or as they're discharged and they're identified, you know, looking at what services they might need and getting them properly connected to those services and ensuring the availability of those services is going to mean that people will have improved quality of life.
Did you want to jump in, Ken?
Sure. I had a call from a family member 2 weeks ago, and I think this is a great example. Woman's son, 25 years old, who has bipolar disorder, went to the emergency room to get help, and he created a disturbance while he was at the emergency room. The police were called. He was arrested. He was brought to the police station and released on bail and walking home before she could get there, and he never received help. So if this person had had mobile crisis response, they might never be in the legal system. And once the person gets in the legal system with mental illness, and I have a family member who's been in this situation, it compounds with bail violations, just as Rose said, and then probation violations, and it just keeps, you know, so yes, I mean, if we can get these folks the treatment that they need early on, then we may divert them from the criminal justice system.
Well, Rose, good luck to you. I know it was hard to make that phone call, so thank you very much for joining us. And let's take one more if we could. Alex is waiting in Rochester. Hi, Alex. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I originally called and was going to talk about the issue of poverty, but I had another issue in mind. I have a friend who was recently discharged from the state hospital in Concord, and she was there for a few months, and I was concerned for her welfare while she was there. She was talking about the conditions there. She had been an inpatient at the hospital in Augusta, but then she was later transferred to Concord. And there was an issue, in my mind at least, the way she was describing it, of coercion, whereby she was coerced to take a higher dosage level of a medication that was already sedating her beyond her level of toleration. And the doctors were saying, well, you can't be discharged until you take this higher dosage level.
Oh, boy.
And her family was like that, too. They're like, well, we're not going to help you be discharged and move into your new apartment until you agree to take this higher dosage level. And I was very concerned, and she didn't even want to look into her legal rights. I suggested she contact the Disabilities Rights Center, but she was afraid that if she did that, it would come back to her family, and she wouldn't be discharged. And I was very concerned about that situation. I was hoping to get your comment on that.
Sure, Alex. And since we're running close to the end, just very briefly, can you tell us what happened in the end with your friend?
Well, she decided to comply because she didn't want to continue to stay at the hospital where she didn't feel safe. There were some other patients there who were occasionally being rowdy and turning tables and throwing chairs occasionally, and she didn't feel safe there. It wasn't like that every day, but she didn't want to stay there, so she decided to comply and take the higher dosage level of medication, even though she knew it would sedate her even further. And so she was recently discharged, but I'm concerned that with her conditional discharge over the longer period, she may not be able to tolerate that higher level of sedation.
Oh, boy. Okay, Alex, thank you very much. And I think I'll turn to you first, Rebecca. Complaints about the treatment of patients at the hospital. Does the settlement talk about conditions there and how things should happen there? This is a very compelling story.
The part of the settlement agreement that focuses on individuals and discharge planning absolutely would help address a transition plan and when it's appropriate for someone to leave the hospital and reintegrate into the community. So working on that process absolutely will address some of those concerns.
And this reminds me of some of the stories that the settlement description actually raises, Amy, stories of, you know, people really struggling. That's why you guys brought the suit.
Right. I mean, I can't say strongly enough how much respect I have first our named plaintiffs who were just so courageous in coming forward and telling their stories.
Six people.
We had six named plaintiffs, many of whom, had years and years of cycling in and out of institutions, some of whom have had prolonged stays at either Glencliff or New Hampshire Hospital. And as Rebecca Woodard said, the discharge and transition planning process for the institutions will include ensuring that people do have access to the community services they need so that it's not a continual revolving door. So I think, there is a extensive process that's put into place so people won't be discharged into homelessness, for example, which is something that we've seen in the past. With regard to what the caller talked about in terms of medication issues, there are some due process protections. Those are issues that the Disabilities Rights Center encourages people to call us about. If there's a way we can be helpful in ensuring that their rights are protected, we would do so.
So Ken, I have to ask you this question. So the money, we talked about this with Commissioner Tumpas. Where's it going to come from? Are you afraid that it's not going to come?
Well, I think that I've talked to Senate leadership, talked to Senator Moore, Senator Bradley, and I think they're very committed. I mean, I think there clearly is bipartisan support that we need to do better for our citizens in New Hampshire that have mental illness. And so I'm confident that the legislature will fund the settlement.
All right. All of you, thank you very much for coming in. I have a feeling we'll be talking about this again. Ken Norton, thank you for your time.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Ken Norton, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire. Rebecca Woodard, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Rebecca Woodard, Assistant Attorney General at the New Hampshire AG's office. And Amy Messer, thank you also for your time.
Thank you very much.
Amy Messer, Legal Director at the New Hampshire Disabilities Rights Center. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with New Hampshire's 2nd District Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer, a Democrat in her first term. We'll talk about some of the major issues on Capitol Hill, including the Affordable Care Act, also the theme of income inequality, and some concerns around veterans' issues. Send us your questions for Congresswoman Custer by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and from Merrimack County Savings Bank, helping the community thrive for over 145 years with 7 full-service branches in Bow, Kentucky, Concord, and Nashua, and the Merrimack.com. And Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org. Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. At least 25 people were killed, more than 200 injured yesterday in Ukraine's capital city of Kiev. In a nighttime assault, police moved in on anti-government protesters who've been camped out behind barricades in independent